Hi all, this is Eccles Cake. Welcome to Verivox, the new audio feature on Veritas Privata. Those of you who have been regular readers will recognize this as a technical update or upgrade for what we've been doing here, which has been the catalog of a church coup. Big scandal in middle America, rural America, the goings on of a small church and its small regional denominational authority, and one pastor who's had to really stand against the tide. This will be the first in a series, we hope, should we get it off the ground, might even move on to upgraded technology, get a nice microphone, maybe sometime we'll even do video. What this will be is sort of the voice equivalent of what we've been doing here, which is commentary on events, interpreting events, and just presenting evidence of what's gone on here, the egregious injustice, among other things. We will have a sense of humor, as we've already had through the blog, so hopefully we'll be both scathing and amusing, but always fair. And we may indeed do some voice interviews, which would be great, but we'll see. This is, again, our first episode, our first audio post, so we'll see how it goes. What I wanted to do today, four things. First, reveal a little discovery that we made over the summer, thanks to one of Simon's newfound supporters. The second will be the latest sort of mini email event between Simon and Aetna's current council as of August and September 2018. The third, we're going to talk a bit about the subculture of Classist Northern Michigan, or rather the subculture in Aetna's geographical area. So what's been going on there and how the church attitude, church subculture there manifests itself in sort of non-church events, so things outside of the church. And finally, we're going to issue an invitation to those in Classist Northern Michigan who may be listening. Hi guys! All right, let's get started. You can read the Article 17 material in the church order for yourself, where it clearly states the minister separated from his congregation is not under discipline. He is to be considered a minister in good standing. Not only that, he's to be offered opportunities for ministry while in between calls. So it not only tells those who are dealing with the minister who's been separated under an Article 17 how to regard him or what his status is, but also how to encourage him. So it mandates an attitude and how to treat him practically. And those of you, again, who are familiar with this case know that certainly he's not been encouraged that way, has not been provided opportunities for ministry. We've gotten confirmation now of what we've been suspecting all along, that these men have not really understood what the Article 17 was, and that they have been treating him like he'd not only done something wrong, but ought to be punished. And certainly they have punished him. Made it very clear that his opinion on anything didn't matter. His questions were inappropriate. He didn't have a right to ask them to explain themselves, to clarify their requirements of him, even to demonstrate that they understood their own obligations under the church order, and even biblically. So that was quite a revelation to get that confirmed, that in fact these men who have been the popes of Simon Templar's case had a misapprehension about the nature of the Article 17 from the beginning. And that, of course, was going to orient them against him, even if they tried to be objective. And, of course, we know they haven't, though how aware of how biased they were is not clear. And, of course, we know how biased as they've proven themselves to be and not conscientious about behaving objectively, even if you have that bias. Your actions are very much going to be tainted, and so will the way you hear and receive the protests, the questions, the arguments, the countering evidence that somebody like Simon Templar prefers and provides. And they have certainly not heard him with an open mind, with any kind of grace. They've been very prejudiced, very clearly haven't been reading or hearing him over these past few years, because they would have known by his citation of the church order that he was not under discipline. It's crystal clear there in the text. And if they'd been interested at all in hearing him, treating him fairly, they would have known this. And of course, one could say they should know this because they're professionals. These are church leaders who've taken on this job. These are delegates to classes who've been given this case to handle. So the men who were originally on the oversight committee volunteered for this. And those men who are now on the classes interim committee, most of whom were on that original oversight committee in 2016, they should know this by virtue of them taking on this position. That is their obligation. They should know their responsibilities. They should know the church order well enough to execute these duties in a responsible way. But they've not proven themselves gracious or conscientious. So it's a real double whammy of incompetence and carelessness and, of course, real bigotry based on ignorance. And we all know that Simon Templar came to them again and again saying, look, this behavior, this attitude you've shown toward me, these decisions you've made, these requirements you've had of me that are completely irrelevant or unfair, these all show that really you think of me as someone who needs to be put in his place, as someone who should be penalized. I don't deserve fairness. I don't deserve benevolence. You just beat me down and tell me to cooperate and be compliant and shut up. Well, so now we know straight from the horse's mouth why that is. They, from the beginning, were tainted by the write-up of Keith Manis and by their own misconceptions that an Article 17 is the triggering of a disciplinary procedure and that Simon Templar this whole time has been under discipline when in fact he has not. Now, as insane as that is, and as validating or vindicating as it is to have this admission, even though they don't realize that actually that's really bad, it should be very embarrassing and should elicit a waterfall of apologies. Oh my goodness, all these actions I've taken based on these false premises. You know, all of this has in fact been, you know, so unjust, so evil because I was confused. I wouldn't listen. I didn't really take this seriously. Well, you know, as bad as all that is, how about our second topic for today? That is Simon Templar's latest interaction with Etna Council from the Christian Reformed Church he used to minister and which separated from him via the Article 17 almost 3 years ago. So we have to declare that officially, we don't officially know if this response was official because Simon Templar's official communication and request for official responses wasn't really responded to by the Etna Council as a whole, but by someone who appeared to be speaking for them. But when Simon asked for confirmation that he was speaking on, that this person was writing on behalf of the whole council, he didn't get that question answered. So we're assuming, for the purposes of this commentary, that this is the official reply, or these are the official answers from Etna Council on these points. So what happened? Well, the attempt or the efforts to get Simon Templar's credentials transferred from classes Northern Michigan to classes Zealand elicited a question from someone in classes Zealand. And that question is actually composed of three parts. The first is, what were the official grounds of the suspension that Etna Council levied against Simon Templar in October of 2015? So what were the grounds for the suspension? Two, was the church order consulted when the decision to suspend him from the pulpit was made? And that was, of course, under the auspices or direction or approval, however you want to put it, of the church visitors at the time, 21 and 22, the Twinkies, Harry and Lloyd. And third, which neighboring consistory or a neighboring church's council agreed with this decision? This is a proviso in the church order. If you're going to suspend your pastor, you have to have official grounds, and another classis in your area or another consistory in your area has to be consulted and they have to agree to it. So these are pretty important points. And why are they important? This is 3 years later. Well, the suspension was the trigger for the Article 17, which was, they too were the sort of initial dominoes that started the rest of this chain of events, everything that's happened procedurally since then. Now, if that initial suspension was invalid, if there weren't official legitimate reasons for the suspension, if church order wasn't consulted, and if a neighboring consistory didn't approve of it, then that renders, well, arguably, that renders all the decisions, all the actions of the classes since then correspondingly illegitimate and invalid. So it's very important that we get an official response to these questions. So in mid to late August, just a little more than a month ago, or about a month ago, Simon Templar contacted Aetna's current council asking these three questions. And one of the elders wrote back in reply. And Simon Templar not only asked the three questions, but also asked for the minutes of the meeting wherein he was suspended. And he got back the minutes for that meeting, but also the one from October 6th, which was, if you remember, the meeting where the council gave him their cobbled together list of requirements, which he then had 3 weeks. Well, he asked for 3 weeks to think about them and respond to them. So he got those two sets of minutes and the following reply. Hi, Simon. I have attached the minutes of October 6th and 27th meetings. I do not wish to engage in debate over procedures or church order. As you are aware, I wasn't on council at the time, and when members were commissioned, I agreed to respect their leadership. I understand that through this whole situation, scare quotes, church counselors, synodical deputies, and a classical interim committee have been involved. I have sent this to you and the stated clerk of classes. Sincerely, the elder. Now, this is a very short email. It's comprised of all of five, maybe six, very basic sentences. First of all, no one asked for a debate on the church order. Second of all, it's quite clear to Simon that this man wasn't on council at the time. But it's interesting that he absolves himself of responsibility to inquire into the legitimacy of their actions by saying that he agreed to respect their leadership at the time. Not a very Berean attitude, but we'll set that aside for the moment and ask, what about respecting the leadership of the pastor or even his personhood? This person was quite eager to grease the wheels of his demise at the time and was one of the real malcontents who helped spur on number 13. But it's an interesting sentence. He says, I understand that through this whole situation, church counselors, synodical deputies, and a classical interim committee have been involved. This, of course, is a misunderstanding, as we know. The whole situation is what exactly? These people haven't been involved at every level. Synodical deputies in particular showed up late to the one meeting, December of 2015, and weren't even prepared. Classical interim committee, you know, it's actually very appropriate that the elder puts all these things in scare quotes. As if they're not, it's not quite true, or they're not quite real. They're just claims by somebody, which they are. But again, this also seems an attempt to eschew any responsibility for explanation or justification of what went on at Aetna. Even now, after the fact, there isn't really a legitimate explanation or real justification for what they did. So you kind of deflect by throwing responsibility onto somebody else. You know, the council members at the time whom I agreed to respect because I'm so righteous. And plus, all these higher-ups were involved and they were running the show and overseeing things, so really, we don't have to think about it. Finally, note, I have sent this to you and the stated clerk of classes. Remember that for later. So the question was, what does Simon do with that? He replied with the following. He thanked him for the minutes, then reiterated his questions after saying, you know, he wasn't interested in debating. It wasn't a request for an argument. He just had three quite simple questions. First, what was the official reason for my suspension? Second, what was the church order? Was the church order used to justify the suspension? And if so, on what grounds? See Articles 82 and 83 of the church order. And thirdly, which local consistory concurred with the suspension? He asked some more questions afterward. He told the elder that, of course, the two former elders who are not number 13 could very well answer any questions that the current council may have. He also said this, quote, I must also admit that I'm puzzled by your reference to church counselors, synodical deputies, and the class's interim committee. Would you please explain to me why you mentioned their involvement? I'm just not clear about how the activities of these denominational officials is relevant to my letter. final in your response from August 29th. You did not say that you were writing on behalf of the council. Were you speaking for the other council members in your note below, or for yourself alone? And then he signs off after thanking him for sending the minutes. Now, for those of you who are expecting some sort of bombshell, there was one, but it was a bit of a dud. So, the reply was the following. Simon, I have talked to current and former elders. I will make this brief. Clearly, the reason for the suspension of pulpit responsibility was your response to recommendations made by council. It was that response that signaled the end of our relationship. To quote one elder, everyone present was shocked, including pastors 22 and 21. Since this was a temporary relief, as stated in the minutes, it didn't need concurrence with Prosper CRC, which is a church down the road from Edna. Since Classis is now handling this, please refer further questions to the CIC, the Classical Interim Committee. Thanks, the Elder. Well, indeed, that was a zinger. Brilliant, profound, professional, very much a clarification of the issues. Oddly enough, he does use that adverb clearly, but actually nothing's clear. The suspension of pulpit responsibilities was Simon's response. What was that response? To recommendations made by council. What were those recommendations? Does this elder even know? He doesn't refer to any source documents, so it's hard to tell. That response signaled the end of their relationship. Well, I suppose that's about as vague as the answer that 42 got when he asked the council at the time, during the announcement of the suspension, what were the grounds? Quick, think of something. Oh, breakdown in communication. That is not a suspendable offense, just for those of you who might be wondering. But apparently he did consult one elder, who's quoted, everyone present was shocked, including the church visitors. I don't quite remember that from Pastor Templar's summary, but I suppose he could have forgotten. Anyway, it sounds like a bit of an embellishment from 13, who was quite fond of terms like anguish. People were suffering, don't you know? He does say, the elder who writes this email, I have talked to current and former elders. Who were they? It'd be interesting to get some names. He clearly didn't talk to Elder 11, the one who repented of all these actions and has stated consistently since that 13 was the one who orchestrated all this. And it was a conspiracy. As funny or loony as that word sounds, we all know it's true because we've all seen the documentation and traced this. Finally, there's the claim that this was a, quote, temporary relief, so it didn't need concurrence with Prosper. This, to me, seems like a bit of fiddling with vocabulary. Trying to go back and declare something that was a suspension, not a suspension. It was something else. It was temporary relief. Therefore, a church order didn't apply. While I'm not an expert on the church order, but this does not in any way sound legitimate. There are no official grounds. None of this was in writing at the time. And it was a disciplinary action that, according to church order, has to be approved. Again, as so many people have said in other contexts, if it quacks like a duck, walks like a duck, and looks like one, it's probably a duck. It was certainly a suspension, and any suspension under the church order has to meet these criteria. But of course, everything Edna Council did was half-assed, not really thought through, and they were relying on the church visitors to guide them through this process. And we've already demonstrated they didn't know what they were doing, nor were they taking their obligation very seriously under the church order. And let us not forget, we were only a week and a half into that three-week suspension when the Article 17 documents were handed over to Simon Templar. So there was no intention even when the suspension was, the ink wasn't yet dry on the suspension before the council and the church visitors started meeting for setting the Article 17 into effect within the few days, within that week. So the suspension wasn't anything but a means to get Simon Templar out of the way while they got the Article 17 material together. It wasn't a temporary relief. It was the precursor to termination. Therefore, they can't make it less than a suspension. If anything, it was more than a suspension, and you can judge that by the resulting decisions, the meetings that followed, and of course, the Article 17 itself. One final postscript on that email. We've already mentioned that the elder seems to be trying to foist responsibility onto other bodies, certainly not himself, and trying to get it off the backs of Aetna councils past and present as well. The problem is, this was Aetna's decision to make. He admits that it was their decision and that it didn't need concurrence with another council. So this was their action, this was the decision they took. Classes can't explain what Aetna did, and therefore they can't take responsibility for it. Aetna Council of 2015 are the only ones who could have explained it if it's explicable. I don't think it is, because it wasn't legitimate. 13 at least wanted Simon Templar gone out of there, whatever it took, and as quickly as possible. Classes wasn't involved in that decision, therefore it can't be their responsibility, and they can't provide justification for it after the fact. So the fobbing off of Simon Templar by this elder to just go talk to the CIC. Well, the CIC can't answer these questions. They weren't there, and it wasn't their responsibility. So once again, we see real failures, not only of understanding, but of leadership. You know, these men really aren't fit for the offices they occupy. And it's scary. It's scary that with there being no pastor at Aetna these last few years, it's people such as these who are responsible for the souls of the flocks under their care, and they simply aren't qualified. I would argue not only spiritually, but also administratively. This is just unacceptable. They should be able to give official answers to these official questions. They can't choose not to answer them. They can't. It's their responsibility to have these things at hand and to take official requests for information seriously and to answer these questions straightforwardly and with transparency. They can't do that. And if they can't do it, then classes sure can't. Finally, after a much longer episode than I thought this would be, but there is plenty to say. Those of you, again, who've been familiar with the blog know that there's always more to say. You can't make this stuff up, and the layer upon layer of truth, of revelation, of people's character, institutional shortcomings, personal suffering, you could write books and books, these sorts of calamities and catastrophes. But finally, after a long post of my talking, I wanted to issue an invitation to members of Classes Northern Michigan, specifically the people on the Classical Interim Committee. I've heard that my blog continues to raise some eyebrows. It's been called divisive. Divisive in and of itself seems to be equated with wrong or unbiblical. I, of course, beg to differ. Jesus said that he came to divide, or his coming, his mission, would divide people. And that's simply what happens when you get people purporting to be Christians who are taking opposite positions on something that demands you choose the right course of action. If you're wrong and somebody else is right, there's going to be this gap. I'm sorry, I didn't choose the gap. I didn't choose for this to happen to Simon Templar. And of course, it's the men who have been challenged over and over again to take their time, to investigate what happened, to do the right thing, to inform themselves, to avail themselves of the information that's been available all this time. I've heard that some of them have read bits of the blog, but, you know, if they disagree, then they should comment to me rather than complaining about the blog to someone else. And I now am extending an invitation. Those of you on the interim committee, you say the blog is divisive. You know, comment, drop me a line, drop me an email. I'd be more than happy to do a phone interview and put it up on the blog asking questions. I will tell you what the questions are in advance, or you can ask me questions. You can challenge the material of the blog. You can challenge the existence of the blog. Again, divisive I don't think means automatically evil or damaging to the church. You know, if you believe that the behavior of leaders in the church is unethical, unbiblical, wicked, and you've in fact tried to stop them from increasing their guilt and from doing further harm, and they don't listen, are you supposed to just shut up and walk away? I don't believe that's the tack that Paul took, or that Peter took, or Jude. All of their criticism was very harsh, very clear when particularly Christians who knew better, or people who weren't Christians but were informed, who were very clearly rejecting God's word, rejecting the truth. You know, these men were apostles and their words are inspired scripture. I'm not saying that I'm inspired or an apostle, but clearly it is not wrong to put your hand up and say, this is bad. This is harmful to the church. This is harmful to a Christian pastor who didn't do anything wrong. This is unjust. This is also incompetent, but we'll set that aside. This is wrong. These are professing Christians who are harming the church's witness to the world. If that's divisive, so be it. You have to pick a side when something is a clear biblical, moral, and gospel issue. Why is this a gospel issue? Well, because we're in an age where word gets out. Pastors beating up on other pastors. Churches being permitted to abuse their pastors in such a way simply for preaching the clear truth. This hurts the witness of Christ in the world. And of course, it hurts the witness of Christ in the church itself. People are disillusioned, discouraged by these things. These are the sorts of events that leave people spiritually traumatized as well as emotionally traumatized. But this is the reason why we have so many Christians who are not in church anymore. Because you can't trust other Christians, especially church leaders. They hurt you. They use the Bible to justify their hurt of you. And they pontificate and act superior while they do it and congratulate themselves. It's a lot of the self-congratulations is perhaps most disgusting. It's bad enough that they beat people around spiritually, emotionally, verbally, ruin their reputations, lie about them, but also publicize how great they are and what a good job they're doing. You know, they're really quite shameless in that regard. Anyway, I renew my invitation to have some dialogue. Again, I'm open to comments, criticism. Please post. Please get in touch. I'm happy to defend myself if I think I'm right and counter your claims, counter your arguments. And of course, if you have justification for what you say and for what you do, then I want to hear them. I would rather all this be out in the open and at least understand, even if it means I'm wrong, than have everything so obfuscated, so much in the shadows, because those of us out here do have a right to know what the reasons are for the decisions that you men of the classes and of the interim committee have made. We have a right as Christians to know why we're being treated this way. I think Simon Templar has a legal right to know and have a record of why those people handling his case have made the decisions they do and regarded him as they do. So again, you know, get down in that comment section, type me a note, type me a question, or send me an email and we'll set up a time to talk, or we can interact in writing and we'll post it here on the blog for everyone to read. Again, prove me wrong. Prove that this sort of divisiveness is bad, or prove that I've been mistaken. Prove that you've got evidence that outweighs everything I've put up, or argue why my evidence is invalid. All I'm asking for is some openness and some explanation. And if I don't get it, well, I think that would again tend to prove my argument rather than yours. Anyway, we've gone on long enough. Hope to have another post up within the next week or two with a further update and some other comments. Watch the comment section below on this post and on any of the others, and we'll see if the CIC or other men from Classes Northern Michigan get in touch. And I'll be trying to line up some interviews with some of the ex-Aetna folk on their involvement in this, what they tried to do to stop it or slow it down, and how it's affected them spiritually and in their lives since. All right, thank you all for listening. We're wrapping up on Tuesday, the 18th of September, and we'll be on again soon, Lord willing.
God bless you all, and our farewell call, Iusque Fasque.